Hello everyone, you're listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, Episode 2. Today we're talking about security news and items of interest for the last 2 weeks, because we did miss last week as Brendan was away. So let's get started. I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong, and
I'm Brendan from ABSH in Melbourne, Australia.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favourite podcast app. So today we'll get started into what we think is probably the biggest topic for what's happened since the last time we talked, which is TeamViewer. And of course, this hit the news in a lot of places, which was TeamViewer, people claiming that they got hacked because of TeamViewer running on their computers. So what's your take on this, Brendan?
Yeah, look, it's there has been a flurry of commentary from industry experts, gurus, even users. I mean, I don't know if you read the Reddit threads, but there was a huge amount of people saying, hey, you know, I'm gaming or I'm working on my machine, and all of a sudden someone's taken control of it and started going to eBay, going to PayPal, trying to get to my bank accounts, people that had saved their passwords in the Internet Explorer or Google Chrome browsers. It's certainly a lot of coincidence. I mean, we had, first of all, users reporting that they'd been hacked. We had users reporting that had been using two-factor authentication that had also had their machines control taken. And then, of course, we had the denial of service attack on TeamViewer's DNS, which saw their website go down for a while. So, personally, I mean, there's a huge amount of coincidence here. I don't know. What's your thoughts on those users that had two-factor authentication enabled?
There's two sides to this, I guess. You know, obviously TeamViewer is saying that, you know, their systems weren't breached, nothing's been hacked, and so on. And perhaps coincidentally, you know, only a couple of weeks before that, you had the big leak of LinkedIn passwords and email addresses. And so there are some people that are saying that, of course, this is happening because people have probably used the same usernames, i.e. email addresses and passwords, as on their accounts on TeamViewer, as perhaps as where they use somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that a breach somewhere else could have obviously happened. And of course, you know, what's happened is that whoever this is gets into the computer, then they look for information around PayPal, eBay, Amazon, Yahoo, Walmart, etc. And if there's information there on those, you know, particularly safe credentials on your web browser or those kinds of things, then they'll log into those and buy stuff and send it somewhere else. Now, is TeamViewer hacked? Well, they're still claiming, of course, that they aren't. And, you know, and until someone categorically comes out and releases, you know, here's a list of TeamViewer usernames and passwords, or here's a 0 day into, you know, TeamViewer bypassing second factor authentication, then I guess the verdict is out. But obviously there are, as you said, a horde of very angry users claiming that TeamViewer has let them down.
They certainly have. I mean, TeamViewer didn't help themselves either. I mean, their initial response really backed them into a corner, and it was rather upsetting for a lot of users. I mean, you know, to blame your users for a hack that was clearly widespread, I'm not sure was the wisest of decisions. Possibly we're investigating, it may have been a better path, but just on the LinkedIn hack, I mean, all those credentials that have been stolen in the past and were released, so you had LinkedIn and a few others. I mean, it is certainly possible with computing these days that, you know, a couple of some groups have taken a whole bunch of lists, cross-referenced them, and built a bit of a dictionary of user accounts that are highly probable of being that user's current credentials. The question then says, though, I mean, if you're using two-factor authentication, how the hell did they bypass that? I mean, the SMS code, or if you've got some type of token, whether you're using Google Authenticator or some other, I mean, it's hugely coincidental. I mean, it's not saying it's not possible, and certainly TeamViewer, I mean, they've been right on this, and I'm not sure it would be wise in this day and age to claim that you haven't been hacked when in fact you are. I think it'd be very difficult for an organization of that size specifically to try to cover up or hide something like that. So I'm guessing there's probably truths on both sides, and I think it's probably going to be a little while before we actually really find out what's happened.
What would be interesting to find out too is actually how many of those accounts were compromised really had second factor authentication enabled, and you know, it wasn't kind of a, oh crap, I haven't done this and I've been meaning to do this for a while. In a lot of ways, this is a good opportunity, and you know, this is something I've been saying online just recently over LinkedIn as well, of course, around that data breach, that if you don't have two factor turned on, turn it on. You know, particularly if you are using, you know, something like TeamViewer, which is, you know, keys to the kingdom for your own computer and potentially banking and whatever other sensitive information you might have, is to make sure that you do go in and you do make use. You know, most large companies and online services these days do have second factor authentication, and if they don't have it, you probably shouldn't be using it. Make sure that you go in and use it. So I know that for me, this is going to be a blog entry for me in the next week, which is, you know, turn on TeamViewer two-factor authentication if you're using it.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just the basics, right? I mean, let's come back to basics. If it is the data from the LinkedIn release, that hack was back from 2012. I mean, if you haven't changed your password since then.
Yeah, I don't want to say you deserve to be hacked, but you kind of do.
I mean, I get it, right? I really do, especially those sites that you don't log into regularly. But, you know, with the amount of apps that are out there, and I guess it's the devil's advocate here. I mean, there's a bunch of password managers that will do that for you. So, you know, you put all your credentials and everything in there, and they will go out and then change your password and remind you, hey, this password's not been changed in 3 months, 4 months. Yeah. Do you want me to go out and change it for you?
Or just use a strong password in the first place. You know, one of the issues, of course, has been traditionally that people use the same password on site after site after site because it's too hard to remember them. And that's where password managers come into this. You know, each site that you do, it can manage a strong password for you. All you have to do is remember the master passwords. You've only got to worry about getting one password right, not all of them.
I guess the key summary or takeaway from it is, you know, where possible and where the provider allows it, enable two-factor authentication. You know, get back to basics. Make sure you're changing your passwords regularly. If you have trouble with that or remembering them, certainly look at using a password manager of some description.
Yeah, I mean, LastPass is probably my favorite recommendation on this. It's well-known, well-understood one, but of course there are many of them out there. So, you know, there are certainly many ways and many different applications to do this, regardless of whatever system you're using.
Yeah, and for the most part, the cost is very negligible. Like, I'm not sure exactly what it costs, but I think LastPass is even under
$10 a year or something.
Yeah. It's not a lot, and correct me on this, Stu. I haven't done a lot of research on LastPass specifically, but I don't think they actually store your password. Like, I think if they are only
what they have an encrypted blob. Okay, they don't. So while they have your password, if you like, they never get it on their system unencrypted. So it never leaves your computer unencrypted. It's encrypted on your computer. It's uploaded to them so that you can sync it to other devices. So if you have a home computer, a work computer, a mobile phone, whatever else, it can be synced there. And to unlock that, you need to know the master password, which is actually the encryption key to unlock it. Yeah. So, you know, they and then even when they do that, of course, you know, what they do even on their own site is then do additional encryption and salting and various best practices around that, which, you know, really would be a podcast in and of itself in terms of how they do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're following industry best practices and they release white papers on what and how they do it, and it's reviewed by security professionals across the globe, and, you know, they've been well regarded in the industry for what and how they do it.
So for those skeptics out there that are thinking that it's just going to become a honeypot for hackers, I guess the advice for those guys is it's probably it increases your overall security, right? So
yeah. Well, the key always is use a strong master password. You know, don't use monkey123 or the other typical easy to remember stuff. You know, make sure that your master password is something that only you know, and then something that wouldn't be easily guessed or in a dictionary attack.
Yeah, spot on, spot on. Now, the next topic that we should probably talk about is our
Calgary
our
Uni. The ransomware wrap up for the week. Right?
I mean, it's becoming like we've almost got a weekly update on ransomware and $20,000 to get university files back. I mean, my first comment on that is, I mean, how do you have a university that doesn't have a reputable backup system?
Yeah, it's a bit weak, isn't it?
I'm not.
100 systems thought to be locked up, including email. So yeah, pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could have been an admin that got it.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, given what it sounds like they've had to go through, it sounds like it probably was the administrator credentials on the system got leaked or got hacked or someone did something that they really probably shouldn't have, and now is a little bit red faced.
Yes. Yes, and it certainly, if we think about just how that has happened, so we've got 100 systems there that were locked up. I wonder if it's this new shift that we're seeing with Zcryptor and ransomware almost becoming worm-like, and once it's infecting the source or it's zero machine, it then starts looking for other machines to encrypt.
Yeah, this is something I know I've posted on some LinkedIn articles in recent months, and I've been worried that this was what was going to happen, that, you know, a lot of the ransomware up until now has just been a single one-off thing. Okay, you get infected, it runs the encryption tool, you get a little pop-up on the screen that says pay the ransom, and it goes away, you know, and it doesn't really do anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been moves recently, you know, first with the sort of making use of your computer to enter a denial of service attack, and the worm concept of that is just sort of the next logical progression. And in fact, you know, I'm surprised it has taken this long in a lot of regards, because, you know, once you're inside the network and running as a particular user, you can just reach out across the network to every other computer that you can find and try and encrypt those as well. So, you know, that's sort of at a very basic level. And of course, if you go a little bit further and you include things like keystroke loggers so that you can get admin credentials or, you know, the actual user's name and password off the machine, then, you know, if you're a little bit more patient and just to bide your time in the background for a few days, you get a much bigger payoff, because you can lock down an entire company, not just one computer on it.
Yeah.
So, scary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, though, is that also, I mean, most of those are heavily reliant on vulnerabilities in the operating system, right? I mean, you could mitigate a lot of that risk by simply having your Windows updates and antivirus software and ports closed on your desktops.
I think it would help, but, I mean, if you look at, for example, how ransomware runs now, even on, you know, machines that are not running as an administrator that are fully patched, what you need is a user simply to run something that they shouldn't, you know, and it can be a Word document or something like that that runs a macro script. I mean, there are now versions of ransomware things that are running in JavaScript or running as Windows PowerShell scripts and all those kinds of things. So that there are, unfortunately, you know, the user has the ability to modify files on their computer. So if you can get them to run something that can make those modifications but do it as an encrypted service, then, you know, you're stuck. So, and, you know, unless you completely lock down the user, which of course is, you know, that comes into, you know, security being inconvenient.
Yeah.
There is a real risk that that this is going to continue and continue for the time being, unless there's a massive change in the way that computing is done.
Yes, it paints a very bleak picture for cybersecurity and even information technology specialists moving forward. I mean, how you protect your internal network, and I guess how you mitigate damage, you know, How do you try and limit it, or do we start branching off and saying, right, finance is going to be on subnet one and sales is going to be on subnet two, and that way at least you're kind of limiting your exposure to only a subset of your overall devices. And I think that's potentially a factor for Calgary Uni. I think one of the reasons they probably had to pay that ransom was, not only the data loss, but also the fact that they had 100 or more systems that were also out of action. It's 100 people at whatever their hourly rate is.
Well, it might have been more than 100 people, you know, if it was the mail system, which is kind of what they're hinting at. You know, that's potentially the entire university staff that don't have email, and students, and, you know, anyone else that actually needs to use the university facilities. So it's, you know, there's sometimes, you know, the reason why ransomware works is because, you know, people aren't necessarily always prepared for the worst case. You know, people get busy. You know, you're fighting fires, particularly in a lot of companies are short-staffed on IT resources, and you know, the typical thing is to who screams the loudest gets the attention for today, and which means that sometimes the background stuff which should be done isn't, because you know there's only so many hours in the day, and your boss is screaming at you to do something else now.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it comes down to what's the quickest way we can get these guys back up and running. And if that's paying a ransom, then sometimes that is the that's the only choice.
Well, police departments have paid it, so
that is very, very true. There's been a number of people that have been caught a little bit red-faced, and I guess the key takeaway and summary for this is, you know, you've got to ensure you've got really resilient backup systems.
Back to basics.
Yeah.
Get your backups right, get your passwords right, all those kinds of things. Make sure you've got two-factor authentication. All that kind of stuff is just a big first step in the right direction.
Would we also lump a bit of user education in there as well, do you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I was at a talk earlier this week, and that was one of the points I raised, was that, you know, even a couple of years ago, I might have said that cybersecurity was the responsibility of the IT department and everyone else, you know, hands off, you know, don't worry about it. If we're doing our job right, you know, things are good. But that's changed now. You only need one infection now on a computer in a company. So, you know, everybody needs to be a little bit aware of what the security risks are, what are things that they should ask about, if nothing else. You know, if this looks suspicious, ask, not just proceed. And then, you know, everyone does their part to make sure that their company and their jobs are ultimately protected.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did some business email compromise testing for a client recently, and 40% of their users actually clicked on the phishing email and followed the link and entered their data, so we obtained their passwords. And clearly some users realized that it wasn't quite working properly because they've entered it three or four times, the password. But when I went out to see them and I spoke to their execs and their team leaders and so forth, no one reported that the staff had actually come back and said, hey, I think I might have messed up, or hey, this looks a bit suspicious. I tried to change my password, but it hasn't worked. So I think you're right. I think the users have a, we really do need to kind of educate them. And there's got to be some better communication between your end users and potentially your technology department.
You know, the sooner you discover that something has gone wrong, the sooner you can stop whatever it is that's happening. You know, and that particularly is the case with ransomware.
Yep.
You know, if you can halt a ransomware when it hasn't got off the computer yet and is still, still doing the local stuff before it gets onto the network, it's so much easier to deal with. If people can just step up and say, I think I've screwed up, I've turned my computer off, can someone come and have a look at it?
Yeah.
And let me know, rather than just continuing on sort of hoping that no one else, because you're going to find out, people are going to know anyway, so just do the right thing to start with. And I think everyone will be happier for it. You know, the odd false positive, if it happens, I think most organizations should rather have that and just have someone, lose 30 minutes of their time while IT comes and takes a look at it and says, you look like you're fine, and continue on. And at least then, they're covering themselves as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I sat down with the leadership team for this particular client. And I said to them, you know, one key point here is, have you actually gone to your users and said to them, there's no blame here, all right? The reporting protocols are, you need to report it immediately. It's not about blame, it's about getting in front of it. So please, even if you suspect, if you're not sure, just report it. But if you're not gone out there and educated your staff and your users about that, then you can't really blame them for wanting to try and hide, because just traditionally people don't want to get in trouble, and bringing down your employer's technology system is probably one that people don't really want to be attributed with. So I think a large responsibility also lies on not only us as technology professionals to educate our clients around that, but also then our clients' leadership teams and management to go out and then also
talk.
Yeah. Keep communication open, sure, guys. That's
absolutely critical. All right. Well, I think that wraps this up for another week.
I totally agree. Thank you for your time again, Stu. Great talking with you.
And likewise, Brenda.
Thank you to all of our listeners also. And tune in next week for hopefully no
a
more
less
news.
Exciting edition.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's keeping us with a podcast, but it would be nice if we had a week where there was no new major breach or so forth. All right,
we can dig up blasts from the past.
That's it. Talk to you later.
All right, cheers.
Bye.
See ya. Bye.